All right, welcome to Dave Lee on Investing. Today we have a special guest, Gene Munster. Gene has been a longtime Apple analyst on the street for probably a decade or two. And he started recently Loop Ventures about 4 years ago, I think. Was it 3 or 4 years ago, Gene?
Right on, just a little bit over three.
Okay. And from my understanding, they do seed investing in AI, robotics, augmented and virtual reality over the past 3 or 4 years. And then Gene also puts out some great blog posts on Apple, on Tesla, and on tech in general. And Gene has been a proponent for Tesla and Tesla, the company and the stock, for quite a while, for many years, and was able to catch the essence of Tesla, but also the essence of Apple early on. And so in this interview, I kind of want to dive deeply into that whole story of how you're able to catch, you know, the big wave of Apple while there is so much confusion with people kind of like, you know, dismissing Apple as a company, but also how were you able to catch Tesla as well while there is so much confusion on Tesla? So that's going to be kind of the focus of today's interview. And I hope everyone gets a lot out of it. And I'm glad to, you know, meet Gene and have Gene share this info with everyone here.
Love it. Can't wait. Fun topic, Dave.
Yeah. I think it's a great topic. So Gene, tell me, how were you able to catch Apple so early? Like, what stuck out about Apple and how were you able to catch it while so many other people dismissed Apple as, like, you know, a huge big winner company in the future?
Well, I think as a starting point, with my days as an analyst and now as an investor, it's always framed in foundation of long-term undeniable truths. And so what we're always doing is experimenting with different products, different themes, different theses, and to see if we can uncover a truth. In the case of Apple, the significance where it went when we first discovered it, it was just a piece of this bigger story. And so if I kind of rewind back to what specifically we saw is that most of the analysts at the time that were covering Apple were viewing it as a computer company, not surprising. And then the iPod came out, and what we saw was a different demographic. We tried it, we liked it, but just because we tried and liked it didn't mean that there was an end market for it. And so we did a lot of feet on the street research and really tried to see what the essence was. Now, one of the challenges back in that time, similar challenge to Tesla, was that iPods had just very few units in the world. And so what we would do is load up an iPod with various types of music, and then we would go into public and interrupt people, essentially. At the time, most were familiar with MP3 players, but there's a different feel to the iPod versus the other players. And so what the initial piece there, I think the spark was, there's something that's different here. We felt that that could appeal to a new audience, and our fundamental belief, and give credit to one of my colleagues who I worked with for many years, Mike Olson, coined this term, the halo effect, that if in fact this does appeal to a new market, then these iPod owners could be pulling over to Mac owners, and that in fact happened. But we didn't, then at that point, that was a 3 or 4 year evolution, is that then it had compounding waves. And so each of those, we thought that, you know, we have to make a new decision towards the kind of the glory at the peak of the iPod. Mm-hmm. We knew that the smartphone was going to replace the MP3 player. And so we had to make a decision. Is Apple in a good place to participate in the smartphone market? And kind of the same conversation around wearables and services. And so we haven't thought about this as an insight that has had legs for a long time. It has been kind of a step piece. And very similar to Tesla. Mm-hmm. I did not go out and buy a Tesla and show it to people. I don't own a Tesla. Mm-hmm. I have an order for a Cybertruck. I have a 2008 Land Rover LR3, which is a labor of love. Mm-hmm. But what we did with Tesla was essentially contacted owners. And I think what was really stood out was this, a very similar type of response of when people did get iPods, for example, how they just insisted on telling you about it. Very mm-hmm. few products do that. Mm-hmm. And we noticed that same behavior with initial Tesla owners, and then it got us thinking about what does this mean and where does this go?
I'm wondering, like back in the Apple days, like early on, was it similar to Tesla in the sense of there's just a lot of different confusion out there and a lot of different narratives on the company? And in that kind of whole confusion, like what was with Apple early on, and let's say pre-iPhone, but also in the early iPhone days, what was it about Apple like that helped you to see through all of the FUD and all of the confusion?
The biggest piece was looking at what the customer recommendations of the customer, the survey, the satisfaction around iPod owners, that was kind of a distinguishing factor, because most kind of viewed this as a just kind of a side business. And so that was the noise around it, is that the iPod could never really amount to anything. It's a great product, but could never amount to anything. And then there was this the piece around doing research on the halo effect. So we saw a high propensity for customers to want to recommend the iPod, and then separately to be introduced to Apple for the first time. And I think if you look back, there was a moment when Steve Jobs talked about hell freezing over, a very infamous moment when iTunes was moved over to Windows. But that, nonetheless, even though it was available on Windows, allow people to experience the iPod and get a taste of Apple's products. And essentially what we, the truth that we relied on to kind of ignore the noise is this is a computer company at a low multiple. The truth was that these products are heavily recommended, and we felt that that could be a market share mover.
Got it. So when the iPhone came out in 2007, there still was a lot of noise around Apple. Some people were dismissing it just as another phone, and what allowed you to see the essence of the iPhone and the potential of this could become something completely, you know, huge?
Was two things. I mean, that we kind of reset at that point and said, this is a new chapter. Will Apple be successful in that? We've been supporters of Apple a long time, and I think it's worth mentioning is that we don't give them the benefit of the doubt. We ultimately have sided and seen their vision over time. But we always ask, is this the right thing to continue to be on board with this? And so in the case of the iPhone, what we ultimately saw, and we would refer to it as a computer in your pocket, that was different. And it was really around the App Store. And initial commentary on from developers, when the App Store first launched, it was a mobile web only. And we went to the developer conference and interviewed many developers, and just heard their enthusiasm and their desire to actually have it be native, actually apps downloaded, which wasn't the case initially for the first year. And so what was the kind of the insight was hearing from developers that this is a new platform. That was very different than the other, I guess, quote, smartphones that were out there that were essentially loaded with software that came from the manufacturer. And so this, you know, was the shift for us, is from the phone to a computer in your pocket.
Okay, got it. So you were able to catch that early on. Did you, early on with the iPhone, did you recognize that it would be difficult for competitors to catch up with the iPhone? And how did you kind of realize that?
That was relatively easy, because at that point you can go and just look at what's out there. And there was always a product that was around the corner. But what you started to understand, what became more clear, and this wasn't the case in 2005 when it was mostly feature phones, candy bar flip phones, was that the aspect of software, the importance of software, I think was an important distinction here. And so that, as I kind of think about the competitive piece, what we look at when these competitors are come out, Palm came out with them, there was many, Gateway had a smartphone, is look at the software. And what we ultimately would do is make a call. Is this, is this up to speed? And the first one that really matched it, of course, was Android. And I think that kind of gets to if I was going to question that is not your current question, but I think a point that's worth noting, if you think about Apple's trajectory, I've studied the details of it. The one strategic mistake that the company has made, they've obviously done a great job, but I think the one piece that could have taken it into a different level was being exclusive with AT&T initially, which gave Android oxygen.
I remember. I remember those days so clearly. I was like a big iPhone proponent. I was like one of the first in line to get an iPhone.
Nice.
Yeah, it was so interesting back in that day because so many people were anti-iPhone, were just like, that's a toy, an expensive toy. A coworker, now wife right now, she was just so dismissive of the iPhone. She's like, I'm never going to use an iPhone, right? I'm BlackBerry for life, right? With email and stuff. And I was like, no, you don't understand what this device is. This changes the game. You know, this is a completely different, this, you can do full web browsing and you can do everything on your computer in your pocket. And she was just like adamant that she would never use it, you know? And I just found it so ironic that something that could seem so obvious to some people, like the iPhone, right, would be the future, just seems so like wrong to other people, you know? And
if I can respectfully jump in, that there is something that we've observed over time that plays into both Apple and Tesla and really all major undeniable truths as those themes emerge, is that the power of these waves take longer than expected, and people have behaviors, and it just takes time to twin them over. When the iPhone first came out, we were we saw it in when it was announced in January that it was released in the following June, and so we had some sense about what it was. We didn't get a chance to actually use one until the first day that it came out, probably close to in line with you that day. But as we kind of thought about that and kind of that trajectory, we were optimistic kind of on the first weekend. I think we had an estimate of call it 300,000 or 350,000 phones would be sold that weekend. And AT&T reported the following Monday morning they had sold 280,000 phones. We were on our call with our institutional sales, and I was, that's a disappointment. 280 is below 350. And as a percentage, it's pretty significant. I missed it. And I remember a question from sales is because there was a lot of anticipation of this, is the iPhone dead on arrival? That I think is really telling because we are so geared for hypermotion that if things don't happen today, it's felt like a disappointment, but these trends take time. And I'm curious, is your wife, what phone does she use today?
Oh yeah, no, she switched over to iPhone like a few years after that, you know. I think it was the initial high price tag when the iPhone first came out. I believe it was like $600, no, you know, subsidy from, you know, the carrier, et cetera. What's interesting is with all these analysts, you'd expect, like, for example, a retail investor would expect analysts in general to be very smart people, to have a pulse on things and to have like more accuracy in terms of predicting, let's say the big winners like Apple than other people, let's say regular consumers. But in some ways, if you take the typical Apple fan or Apple consumer who saw like, you know, Apple's evolution and the iPhone, they might have been better predictors, right? Of the future in terms of the company.
Same with Tesla.
Yeah, same with Tesla. Why is that the case? Why is it that a lot of analysts just don't get like the big winners like an Apple or a Tesla, and they're so skeptical of those type of companies?
There's an aversion to people who, in reference to drinking the Kool-Aid, and that I think those very passionate groups are generally discounted. And when they come up ultimately in conversations with, as an analyst, as you internally are thinking about how this plays out, I think many analysts use that as that it is a fad. I think that is a strike. Second is that there are some incredible analysts out there. And I enjoyed my time as an analyst very much. I think that there is sometimes a self-preservation mode that everyone has too. Is it right to stick your neck out? When we initially got behind Apple, it was after the dot-com blew up. And so it was a few years after that. And so what you had was Wall Street was in a mode that big price targets were for analysts who were out of touch with reality, because that's what happened in the dot-com boom, is these massive price targets. So there was 3 or 4 years where there was virtually no movement. The analysts, the price targets would be a few dollars ahead of wherever the stock was, almost no movement. And we had predicted that Apple would be a $100 stock at the time, split adjusted. Don't remember what the math was. But I remember going into our meeting that morning, and the head of distribution, head of sales, mentioned to me, "You better be right on this or you're out of a job." And I think that that is one of the reasons why you don't see analysts. I think they've gotten better over the years, definitely have gotten better. But I think that's part of the reason too.
Got it. Do you think also, I mean, like, with the street and Wall Street and the markets being so kind of short-term driven, let's say in the next year or two, that analysts also kind of get, you know, buy into that whole short-term driven culture, wanting to, you know, just look a year or two out rather than the 5 or 10 years out. And because of that, like the long-term kind of big winners that you need to look 5 or 10 years out might not be as appealing as like something that is more secure kind of, you know, over the next 1 or 2 years, right?
It's a theme on what we just talked about too, is that it's more, it's safer to play the next 2 years versus make some sort of a prediction that's maybe outside of that window that adds you, adds some risk. I was, have continued to be, pay the price for a prediction that I made that Apple would come out with a TV. I think that's kind of a representative of the downside to this is, you know, you still live with that legacy. And I think a lot of analysts don't want that risk.
Got it. I noticed, like, you know, at times, let's say in this recent Tesla run, this past, let's say 4 months or so, you know, Tesla went from like 300 to 900 back down, but back up. But like, I noticed a lot of analysts were just upping their price target as like the stock would get way ahead. So they had, let's say, a $200 price target, but Tesla was going 500, 600, 700. And so they were kind of forced to up their price target maybe to 300 or 400. And when Tesla goes up, then they're just forced to up their price target. And it kind of feels a little bit like kind of reactionary, like they're just doing it because they have to, because, you know, they're so far off now. And it seems also like the herd is doing it. All the analysts are now, you know, raising their price target, so they also have to raise the price target. I mean, is that something like you saw as an analyst, kind of like the herd mentality, or just analysts just following along, let's say with Apple especially, you know, just having to catch up to the price?
There is a compliance component to it about what is a overweight rating, and each investment bank has its own criteria about what a rating justifies for an implied price target. So, for example, a strong buyer buy each, again, they have different languages at different banks, but has a certain criteria that you need to put. So if you are, let's say, for example, neutral on a company and the stock goes up 2x from where you were neutral, the compliance department would say you either have to downgrade the stock or you need to rethink your thesis and say, is there a reason for this to keep going? It's a good governance. Compliance departments, I love them. I think that they make the analyst's life much easier. And so I think there are some rails around that cause that reaction.
Got it. In your experience, just generally, like these analysts, how deeply are they really like researching and involved in a single company versus, let's say, you know, a whole industry, you know? Like, are they researching, like, let's say, a dozen companies at the same time, or can they actually focus on, let's say, a single one or two or three companies?
Most of them have a coverage list, which typically is, depends on how big the team is. It can be as few as 5 or 10, and can be as many as 30. And I think it's just a really wide range. Sometimes the way these teams are structured is that you may have a senior analyst, then you have very competent, seasoned, tenured analysts that work with that, that take different segments, different companies, and they're the experts. The senior analysts may get, will get the credit for it, but they have people who are laser focused. And so I think, you know, there are, I think 50,000 analysts, sell side analysts, and it's a really broad range over, and occasionally you do see an analyst that just says, I'm just going to cover one stock and do it exceptionally well. The challenge with that, though, is no company operates in a vacuum. And so, for example, to cover Apple well, you need to also cover Google. Understand what's going on with their mobile strategy and market share and how they're interacting. And so you really can't just focus on one. You have to focus on coverage universe, as we would call it.
Got it. Got it. Are there any like bonuses some analysts get for like moving the stock after a certain report comes out?
I've never heard of a, a bonus. There may be out there. I've never heard of that. There may be incentives around. We were incentivized on our performance, what our how our ratings did versus the stocks, and so we would get a grade from that, and that was part of our compensation, which it should. And that's aligned interest with the investor.
Got it. Going back to Apple, because I've Apple is kind of in my kind of history has been like a huge part of my journey, because in 2008 I actually started a app company right after the App Store started, because I'm like, this is this is huge, right? The App Store. I thought it was going to be the next big thing. And so
it was,
and it allowed our company to get started and actually have a chance, you know, even without any software experience myself. It allowed us an opportunity just to be early in the App Store. So I mean, Apple was such an amazing story the past, you know, 20 years. Like, with the passing, going to the passing of Steve Jobs, like, were you surprised at all at how well Apple has executed post Steve Jobs?
No, I'm not. I, you know, you can look at the stock, and again, there's like these incremental layers up around services that we have to, but as far as the execution side, we always knew that that was going to be in great hands. Tim Cook stands above any other CEO I've ever interacted with or observed or studied. He is a, just a leader. His intention to detail is incredible. His attention to action is inspiring, and he's a good person too. It's a wonderful combination. And so I felt from a structure standpoint, and he obviously was trained and groomed for that role, it was in good hands. There's always the question around innovation, how would that continue and evolve, but I knew that it was in good hands.
Got it. Segueing to Tesla, like, do you feel like, let's say if something happened to Elon, and someone else had to take over, do you feel as confident as you did with Apple, or are you, do you have some doubts of how well Tesla would execute going forward without Elon?
Tesla could execute, well. Tesla is better with Elon. Need to make sure that that is clear. I hope Elon stays with Tesla. But it is, it has some similarities in that within Apple's case, you know, the, there is a kind of a long-term, the, from the visionary with Jobs, a long-term roadmap, product roadmap was way, it was laid out. And Elon Musk last night talked about his brain being full with the number of projects that they have going on, you know, including HVAC, for example, heating cooling systems. So I think that there is, and the foundation of what they've outlined with their car lineup, that can take the company for the next 10 years. And so I think they're in great shape.
Got it. Got it. With Apple and Tesla, like, how do you see the differences? Like, let's say Tesla in terms of how they execute, how they innovate. You mentioned earlier how consumers were fanatical, were excited about, you know, the product with Apple, the iPod and iPhone. And, similar with Tesla. Are there any other similarities that you notice just, you know, between Apple and Tesla?
I think the there's similarity in terms of how customers feel about their products. They both both those companies stand alone in that regard. There's similarities in terms of how they want to verticalize, basically do hardware, software, and services together, and the benefits around that. That was not always the case. Not all companies believe in that. It's a much more difficult road to go to do it all. But those are similarities. And I think that that is part of the reason that vertical integration is part of the reason why the consumers feel so compelled to tell friends about these two companies. So those would be some of the similarities.
Okay. On vertical integration, I noticed like there's some people on YouTube and Twitter and other places who have been talking about Tesla ought to license their powertrain. But from my background of understanding vertical integration with Apple and seeing the benefits of an integrated product, the end consumer experience, it just seems like it would be so antithetical to Tesla. It would be so against the whole ethos of Tesla to, you know, I guess, chop up their technology or chop up their experience, you know, and license, you know, let's say their powertrain or something. I don't know. What's your take? Do you think there's a possibility Tesla would, you know, make powertrains for other OEMs or not?
It's agree on the ethos. I think it's unlikely. Elon Musk has said that is a potential. Mm-hmm. A lot of things are potentials. He has clearly embraced that idea that they could go this direction. So I do not believe that Tesla is going to go there. I also believe that, or I don't believe, this is, I think, about as close to a fact as you can get. Elon Musk is a fighter, mm-hmm. and will keep his options open if he needs to. And so I think on the current trajectory that they're on, I do not expect them to license their stack.
Got it. How bullish are you with the Tesla Robotaxi network?
Long term, I'm bullish. Long term, I would say 5 or 10 years. Mm-hmm. There was some comments I wasn't sure how to interpret them on their earnings call last night about the timing of Robotaxi.
Yeah, I heard you asked that question during the conference call. That's great.
Yeah, I'd be curious in what your response to what your interpretation of that was. It sounded like they think they'll have the fleet operating by the end of next year. That's his guess. Maybe it's a little bit earlier. Maybe it's later. He said he shoots for kind of the middle of the standard deviation point. Uh-huh. Was that your interpretation too?
Yeah, I mean, Elon gave a lot of qualifications for his estimates, which I thought was interesting. I think it kind of highlighted for me the unknown factor of timing with Robotaxi. It's just is so unclear, you know, even in on their side, I think.
What I would weigh in is this is a big part of what Elon's working on. And there is meaningful leverage to everyone's life if Tesla can advance this. When I say meaningful leverage to everyone's life, what does that mean? Mm-hmm. It is the cost of ride sharing should go down. It should go down if Waymo is successful, but Tesla has this other kind of scaling factor on manufacturing. And to answer your question is I am optimistic about this. I think that we will see a day where the Robotaxi fleet is. I think we're years away though.
Got it. In 10 years, do you think Robotaxi Network will make up over half the valuation of Tesla or less than half?
I bet it's more than half in 10 years.
Okay. Got it. With supposedly Tesla's going to come up with a battery day end of May. Do you think Tesla is going to make their own battery cells? Do you think they need to?
Don't have a strong view on it. They don't need to. Mm-hmm. It is the relationship and batteries Panasonic is a competitive advantage. I think that when you think about vertical integration and the importance of battery yield, I think that there is an opportunity for them to do that. I'm kind of going into this with eyes wide open, can go either way. Mm-hmm. If you're going to ask if I had any influence in strategy, I would very much want to verticalize and own the battery because mm-hmm. that's when the vice grip just gets at a crushing pressure on the competition when they can start to have outsized battery performance.
Got it. And that reminds me, you wrote something recently, and I'll just read it here. It says, we believe it's likely to get progressively more difficult for traditional auto to catch up to Tesla as demand is outpacing the broader industry. As the company scales to meet demand, Tesla's price performance gap versus other car makers will widen. This is because other car makers are producing EVs at subscale, which creates a dilemma. If traditional auto releases a car with features and range at parity and sells a car at cost, it will be priced 10 to 25% higher than a comparable Tesla. This will soften demand and lead to further market share loss. If traditional auto subsidizes vehicle costs to gain market share, they will lose money with limited margin cushion. The more they sell, the more money they lose. Taking it to the logical end, we believe car companies that have been around for 50 plus years will eventually, 10 years from now, be forced to restructure or go out of business. Can you like expand kind of on your thoughts from that?
Yeah, I think it is how bad it is for traditional auto, how tight of a spot that they're in is largely not understood. You could look at the market caps of large companies versus Tesla and say that the market gets it. But just the concept of thinking about a major, I'm not pointing fingers at anyone in particular, and a major automotive company being a fraction of the size in the future is surprising. And to think about today, a company like a massive market share, maybe Toyota or GM, and let's call it 15% global market share. But the concept of a company having 25% share or higher, that seems, you know, if you just use historical measures, unlikely. But I think that is the trajectory we're on. I don't have a good answer of how traditional auto gets out of the spot that they're in.
Yeah. I mean, because you, in that whole article, you noted like it's a vicious cycle because Tesla already has the demand, and they make more, they get better costs, right? They can produce a better car at a cheaper cost, but then another OEM comes in, but they can't meet that performance at that cost. So they have to charge higher and they lose money, and that weakens their overall position. But if they charge lower, then they lose money, right? And so what do they do, you know?
Yeah, the insight from Elon Musk was, you know, focusing on the machine that makes the machine. That piece of it, I think, is what is, you know, he really wanted to redesign. This is his first principles, take everything and break it down to the most basic level, the car manufacturing process. And I think that even though it was painful with Model 3, and we're far from out of the woods. The Tesla story, 2020 is going to be a tough year for Tesla. It's going to be a lot tougher for every other automaker. But I think they're making a lot of progress to that. And that's exactly right. One just final thought on that for traditional auto. Ultimately, they need to have investors that understand the importance of losing money for sustained periods, years, for the long-term viability. And that's a tough proposition to sell to investors.
Got it. You know, actually, I've been actually dying to ask this question to you because I think you understand the phone market and the car market. I noticed with the phone market back in the day, it was so fragmented. There wasn't a clear, like, standout phone or company pre-iPhone, right? You had Motorola, BlackBerry, and all these other Samsungs. And it reminds me a lot of the current auto market where it's so fragmented. There isn't like a single car company besides Tesla, say, that like dominates. And the two markets kind of seem similar. And it kind of reminds me where I was thinking a few years back, I'm like, you know, the car markets, the fragmentation of the car market shows me there's weakness. There isn't that standout winner that maybe Tesla could be, right? And dominate the market. Just like back in the day with the phone, everyone hated their phone, and there wasn't a standout winner, and Apple just went in and just completely shattered, you know, the whole market. I mean, do you think there's some correlation to that with the fragmentation of the car market showing that there's ripe opportunity for disruption?
I think there is. It is a sign of disruption. You know, what the phone market looked like, it was kind of a tale of two markets. There was the candy bar and flip phones, and then there was RIM and Research in Motion. So, but yeah, definitely fragmented. Car industry is fragmented by definition.
Yeah.
It's if you look at search, e-commerce, social, you have all these massive, massive winners. Apple has 18% share in smartphones, which is the largest single. Samsung has more share, but just the number of SKUs, they have highest share per SKU. But I see a big opportunity to consolidate and kind of get that flywheel moving.
Yeah, got it. You mentioned 2020 is going to be a tough year for Tesla, but more so for other auto OEMs. I mean, are you surprised the stock price has bounced back so quickly after, like, you know, hitting sub 400 just like a month or so ago?
Yeah, I'm surprised. I think it shows that Tesla, actually, despite all of its controversy, the controversy on Tesla is intensity level is at a different pace than it ever was with Apple. Mm-hmm. Am I surprised? I am surprised at the quick V recovery. I'm surprised at the market's recovery as well. I think that mm-hmm. 2020, unfortunately, is going to be a difficult year for a lot of us in a lot of different ways. Mm-hmm. But I was surprised. But when I saw the numbers of deliveries that came out, and we were expecting deliveries far below the 80, whatever it was, 487,000 mm-hmm. they did in the March quarter, I thought it was going to be, could be even in the 40s, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. given everything that was going on. So when I saw that, I had a good sense that things were going to go higher.
Got it. Got it. I want to ask your opinion on like Tesla's competition. Let's say, like if you look at some of these other companies like Apple with this Project Titan, or let's say Google with Waymo, or let's say, you know, Amazon needing to get into autonomous driving for just their logistics, right? For delivering packages, et cetera. Like, how do you view that kind of landscape going forward? Like, which company has like a chance to get into that market or has ambition to do so, right? To compete, let's say, in the auto market?
Google does, mm-hmm. obviously through Waymo, like you mentioned, but that's more on the robotaxi side. Mm-hmm. And I think the consumer side is different. Tesla is going to do both of them. Mm-hmm. I think the biggest threat to Tesla is Apple. What Apple does in cars is very difficult to predict. They've had different variations about what they've done, their approach in Titan. I don't even want to make a prediction because it's just so mm-hmm. hard, because I think they're ultimately trying to figure it out. Mm-hmm. And building a car is, of course, orders of magnitude more difficult than phones. And so even if you have a third party do it, it's still. So to answer your question, I think that the real long-term competitor to Tesla is Apple.
It's really?
Not traditional automotive. Uh-huh. It's not going to be Google, and it won't be Amazon.
Wow. So, I mean, I know Bob Mansfield, you know, took over Project Titan a few years ago, and I thought that was like a big sign that Apple was very serious, you know, with their car plans. I mean, I haven't heard too much recently about Apple's car plans. I mean, have you been keeping up at all with, you know, how they're progressing?
There's a lot of noise there. Don't know. When I say it's their biggest competitive threat, they mm-hmm. just have the resources, the attention to detail, vertical integration, to be a real player here. They can invest in something for 5 years and you wouldn't even see it come through the income statement. Mm-hmm. So that's why I mentioned it. It wasn't because I think that Apple is working on a ready to roll out a car anytime soon.
Got it. Got it. A few last questions I'm dying to ask you. Peloton, do you think Apple can get into the whole connected fitness space and be a competitor to Peloton?
I think they want to have kind of a universal devices, whether it's, the answer to your question is no, I don't think that they're going to come out with a fitness device.
Okay. Interesting. And the final question is, I've had several people ask me this on Twitter to ask you on my behalf, but or on their behalf. What other public companies out there, public stock, do you see as potential like big winners, like an Apple or a Tesla? Are there any on your radar that you might just, you know, be considering or looking at?
So we have to put the proper disclosures here. Do not own this, and people should invest at their own risk.
Definitely.
I think a company that is playing into an undeniable truth is Zillow. I think they're getting a lot of heat for what they're doing, with a lot of pushback, a lot of concern about what they're doing with the offers they're making and taking some inventory. But essentially what they're trying to do is vertically integrate the real estate industry, which has not innovated. Mm-hmm. And I think that is a really exciting, I think people are underestimating what the power of that could be, just to take a lot of friction out of our everyday lives. It's crazy too how often people actually use Zillow, even if you're not in the market for them.
That's true. I mean, it's a time suck. All right, Gene, I want to thank you. You know, man, I'm actually dying to ask a ton more questions, especially I know you're big on undeniable truth, you know, on like when you're analyzing companies. I'd love to do another interview or something to go a little bit deeper on a few other topics. But I know we have limited time in this first interview, but I just want to thank you on behalf of my viewers and everyone watching for just being generous with your time, sharing your experience about Apple and Tesla. And I just wanted to, show my appreciation for that. Thank you.
The honor was all mine. Thank you.
Great. All right. Thanks, Gene. We'll talk to you later.
Bye-bye.
Okay. Bye.